Well, hello. This is Get Ready for Sunday from Corpus Christi Catholic Church in Tucson, Arizona. Thanks for clicking in. It is good to devote a little thought and prayer to prepare for the Sunday Eucharist, and I want to thank you for taking some time to do that. I'm Deacon Mark from Corpus Christi, and the next few minutes will be devoted to background on the scripture readings coming to a Mass near you on the 14th Sunday of Ordinary Time, Lectionary Year B. I didn't get around to talking about the selection from St. Paul's second letter to the Corinthians last week. This week, we're still in that letter, albeit four chapters deeper into it. Last week, we were hearing part of Paul's work as fundraiser. Yes, fundraising has been part of the church's operation since the very beginning. The situation was a need for financial support of the Christian community in Rome, which was living in very dire circumstances. Having had some responsibility myself for doing charitable fundraising in the past, and having been demonstrably poor at the job, I take a special interest in looking at Paul's technique here. I suppose my experience of encountering the difficulties of the process colors my curiosity a bit. The first statement of the passage is complementary to the Corinthian community, a good strategy for a fundraiser. You have shown an ability to grow in faith and understanding, Paul says. He urges them, therefore, to take the request for giving money to support those in need with the same attitude. It's a keep up the good work approach. Then comes a reminder of the relative ease with which the Corinthians can provide the gift that is requested of them when compared to the gift they have received from Jesus. To rephrase Paul into a blunt statement, Jesus died. You're asked only to spare some of your abundance, and it'll come back to you. You keep them alive now, they'll keep you alive later. Finally, Paul quotes from the 16th chapter of Exodus, where rules were laid out for the gathering of manna during Israel's travel through the desert. At Mass, we heard, "Whoever had much did not have more, and whoever had little did not have less." A more nuanced translation makes the point, I think, a little more clearly when it reads, "The one who gathered much had no excess. The one who gathered little had no lack." Paul thereby has framed the request for funds firmly within the ancient Jewish tradition and has brought it forward into the example for right relationship set by Jesus for them. Paul makes his case clearly. One's response to this request for aid is a measure of one's level of faith in and commitment to Christ. The segment we read this week immediately follows a section where Paul, as he writes, is boasting as a fool about the hardships he has endured for Christ and of visions given him of God's glory. Now, in the passage we hear, he both admits to the painfulness and to the spiritual usefulness of an unspecified thorn in the flesh. This he learns to endure so that he might come to the recognition of his own relative powerlessness in fulfilling his mission to evangelize. From this weakness, this persistent thorn, he comes to understand more fully that his effectiveness for Christ's work comes when he recognizes his own inadequacies. From that understanding, he can allow God's grace to be his source of energy and to work through him for the sake of the gospel. This is his most humble boast. "When I am weak, then I am strong." This is his understanding at last of Jesus' message to him, "My grace is sufficient for you." This week we hear this reading from the second letter of St. Paul to the Corinthians. brothers and sisters, that I, Paul, might not become too elated because of the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, an angel of Satan, to beat me, to keep me from being too elated. 3 times I begged the Lord about this, that it might leave me. But he said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. I will rather boast most gladly of my weaknesses, in order that the power of Christ may dwell with me. Therefore, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and constraints, for the sake of Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong." The Word of the Lord. Moving on, we can look at the matched set of thoughts to be found in the first reading from the book of Ezekiel and in today's Gospel passage from St. Mark. First, some historical context for Ezekiel. The indications are strong that he was a priest in Jerusalem, and a prominent one at that, immediately prior to the 2 sieges of the city by the Babylonians in the 6th century BC. His high status is attested to by the fact that he was among the first wave of Jews to be exiled to Babylon in 597 BC. The first group taken out of Jerusalem consisted of the community's civil, religious, and military leaders and others of great influence. 4 years into that exile, Ezekiel heard God's call to be a prophet for the people of Israel. It came in the form of an extraordinary vision he had along the banks of the river Shebar in Babylon. The first 3 chapters of the book of Ezekiel recount the content of that vision and call. It is a small sample from this recollection that we hear this Sunday. There is general scholarly agreement that the book is primarily the work of a single author, whether Ezekiel himself or a follower, with perhaps a small number of later editions. I find keeping track of the timeline as presented in the book to be a bit vexing. The oracles contained in its first 32 chapters purport to be from before the fall of the city, yet the book as a whole was not written until after a second siege of Jerusalem in 587 and a resulting second exile. The book deals with the challenges the Jewish people encountered after that second exile. Its general themes center on the defiling effects of becoming a sinful people, on God's subsequent abandonment of the city, and on aspects of divine power and authority. Echoes of this book's content and style are found in the book of the prophet Zechariah, in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and in the New Testament's book of Revelation. The passage read at this Mass sets out the fundamental challenge faced by any prophet called to speak God's truth within his or her own community. It is the same as that problem encountered by Jesus in today's Gospel story. The role of a true prophet is not mere gazing into the future, as popular culture seems to understand it. The true prophet is called to deliver God's truth to a people that has strayed from it. When the people in question are one's own countrymen or kin or friends, it becomes a choice between ignoring God's call or standing in opposition to those people with whom one has the closest relationships. God makes the challenge clear by describing the people as rebellious, with a long history of stubborn behavior. Success for Ezekiel, God tells him, is not necessarily to move the people to change their ways. Ezekiel's task from God is successful when he is delivering the message with sufficient strength and clarity. As God says in this passage, "Whether they heed or resist, they shall know that a prophet has been among them. Was that God doing some groundwork so that he might later tell a recalcitrant Jewish people, "Hey, I told you so"? Whatever the circumstances, Ezekiel continued to be active in his prophetic call until at least 571 B.C. Here then is a reading from the second chapter of the book of Ezekiel. "As the Lord spoke to me, the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet. And I heard the one who was speaking say to me, 'Son of man, I am sending you to the Israelites, rebels who have rebelled against me. They and their ancestors have revolted against me to this very day. Hard of face and obstinate of heart are they to whom I am sending you. But you shall say to them, Thus says the Lord God. And whether they heed or resist, for they are a rebellious house, they shall know that a prophet has been among them.'" The word of the Lord. This short passage from Ezekiel's work prefigures the rejection Jesus faces among his own neighbors. The psalm today is a community lamentation and a pleading to be relieved of the consequences of straying from God's path. It is composed using the first four verses of Psalm 123. As usual, I will read the responsorial psalm only twice, at the beginning and at the end of the last strophe. "Our eyes are fixed on the Lord, pleading for his mercy. To you I lift up my eyes, who are enthroned in heaven, as the eyes of servants are on the hands of their masters, as the eyes of a maid are on the hands of her mistress, so are our eyes on the Lord our God, till he have pity on us. Have pity on us, O Lord, have pity on us. For we are more than sated with contempt. Our souls are more than sated with the mockery of the arrogant, with the contempt of the proud. Our eyes are fixed on the Lord, pleading for his mercy." So we move on to the gospel of the day. This short scene from chapter 6 of Mark's gospel, dramatic as it is, contains one of two times where Mark mentions family members of Jesus. In doing so, he uses the terms brothers and sisters. This can be very distracting for us Catholics, given the Church's teaching about the perpetual virginity of Mary. You need not fall prey to this ambiguity. In Mark's day, brother or sister did not necessarily mean that they were offspring who shared the same father and mother. It was common to refer to members of one's extended family, cousins and others further removed from the nuclear family included, as brother or sister. Additionally, the Church teaching follows the tradition held by the very earliest Christian communities concerning Mary's virginity. Whatever the historicity of the claim, it should not be allowed to distract from what should be our central concern, the person of Jesus. Here then is a reading from the Holy Gospel according to Mark. Jesus departed from there and came to his native place, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many who heard him were astonished. They said, "Where did this man get all this? What kind of wisdom has been given him? What mighty deeds are wrought by his hands? Is he not the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his native place, and among his own kin, and in his own house. So he was not able to perform any mighty deed there, apart from curing a few sick people by laying his hands on them. He was amazed at their lack of faith. The Gospel of the Lord. There is a lot going on here, both in what happens and in what does not happen in this encounter with the home folk. As a starting point, let's remember that the social norms in the Mediterranean world at the time were centered around honor. The most powerful factor in determining the extent of one's honor, one's position in society, was the circumstance of one's birth. This is called ascribed or inherited honor, and it is still a very powerful force today in much of the world. A second way for one's honor in society to be elevated was through notable accomplishments, demonstrating wisdom that enriches the community, prevailing in wars to safeguard the borders, such things as that. Hold on to those thoughts as we go through the rest. Mark places this scene quite early in Jesus' public life, but not at the very beginning. His gospel has already recounted Jesus' power over evil with the exorcism of a man possessed. He has performed miraculous healings, and in the immediately previous chapter, he has raised Jairus' daughter from death. His audience was aware of all this. Now he appears before them in the synagogue and teaches, a position available only to qualified males. Jesus is brilliant. He demonstrates a level of understanding and wisdom previously unheard. Many were astounded at his teaching and at his reported mighty deeds. Surely this will move him upward in honor with the community. But no, it does not. Jesus is among the people most familiar with him from early in his life. Questions about the source of his brilliance come flying out of the crowd. The circumstances of his birth are recalled by the group. Mark calls him Son of Mary. That's an unusual identification. One's identity is customarily based on one's father. The sons of Zebedee, James and John. Simon Bar, that is, son of Jonah. This unusual identification perhaps hints at a question of the legitimacy of his birth, the identity of his father. As the crowd begins to examine in this way Jesus' qualifications to be teaching at all, they ask things like, "Isn't he the son of an artisan?" This is usually rendered as carpenter, but the original Greek word also applies to stonemasons and others who would be in the building trades. Where could such a man get what Jesus seems to possess? Artisans in small communities like Nazareth had to go to larger cities in order to find employment, leaving their mothers, wives, sisters, daughters, without the requisite male protector that was needed to maintain the family's honor. As a class of laborers, they were seen as without shame. This is the kind of man we should listen to? So it would seem that for Jesus, the lack of family prestige, the lack of inherited honor, proves to be pivotal in the group's refusal to grant him the recognition he merits. This holds true despite their apparent recognition of the truth within his message. Their preconceptions nullify the reports of miracles and allow them to disregard the truth and wisdom they have just heard come from his teaching. Jesus leaves the crowd with a zinger. He quotes what is apparently a common aphorism found in Greek literature of the time about prophets denied acceptance in their own towns or their own families. And it is also a continuation of the Old Testament motif of prophets rejected by those who are most familiar with them. As I read this, he seems to be shaming those present as they are rejecting him. There is an open question, at least a debatable one, concerning whether or not the crowd's lack of faith actually restricted, that is, placed an insurmountable barrier on, Jesus' power to work mighty deeds. One commentator has suggested, and it's quite insightful, I think, that it might have been Jesus' decision to withhold such works in the obvious absence of any willingness to accept them on the part of the crowd. Today, the Church's own teaching on the effectiveness of sacraments speaks of disposition, that is, the willingness of the recipient of grace to cooperate with that which is given them. That is when the fruit of sacrament comes forward. Either way, the crowd got no great works, with the exception of some who did accept his healing ministry. This is the second time that Mark shows us Jesus teaching in a synagogue. The first time was related in chapter 1 and was in Capernaum, immediately after he called his first disciples. The scene today is not just the second, it is also the last time that Mark records Jesus teaching in a synagogue. As a whole, among other things, this scene points to the difficulty we all seem to have in recognizing the presence of God, of saving grace, when it comes to us in some familiar form. Prophets are much easier to listen to when they are from a time long past and a place far removed from us. The ones who show up in our faces, urging us to make changes in our lives, our attitudes, and behaviors, with those we often have serious difficulty. Jesus, the stories of Jesus and his teaching can take on the characteristic of a mere background story around which some of us try to center our lives, but it can become a taken-for-granted relationship and thus diminish our willingness and our ability to actively engage in the continuing life of Christ and the continuing mission of Jesus to bring about a kingdom of peace and justice in this world. How about we commit to work to prevent that from happening? After all, staying enthusiastically connected to the work is where all the fun is. It is where life itself is to be found. That's enough for today. I invite you to go to Mass, whether in person or online, as you are able, and may God bless you.